This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Moving to a new place can be hard. You don't know your way around town. Maybe you're far away from friends and family. Charles Robert McIvey recently moved to the Madison area and submitted a question through WPR's Why Sconson project. Charles asked, how does one become a local? What do people need to know to acclimate? Those are questions our next guest has spent a lot of time thinking about. She's got some strategies for putting down roots and loving where you live, wherever that is. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How long does it take you to feel comfortable after moving to a new place? What things help you feel more at home? Do you feel like you have a sense of community where you live, no matter how long you've lived there? Have you moved a lot? Is it tough to get rooted in a new place? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melody Warnick is author of the book, This is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, If You Could Live Anywhere, The Surprising Importance of Place in a Work From Anywhere World. Melody, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you write in your book that you've had a lot of experience moving from place to place in your adult life. What is it that finally hit you that, hey, in this place I am right now, I'm going to make an effort to become a local and put down some roots?
So my family had just moved from Austin, Texas, to a small college town in Southwest Virginia. My husband had gotten a new job at the university, and my kids were starting fifth grade and kindergarten, and I absolutely hated it there, did not feel at home, but recognized that we were probably going to be here for the long haul. My pattern before that was just to keep moving, you know, keep looking for the next best place. And finally, in this little town of Blacksburg, Virginia, I thought, I need to learn how to feel at home here right now. I can't just wait until we move again. And so that started me on this journey of trying to figure out what it takes for people to feel at home in a new community or an old one, and what kinds of actions we can take to facilitate that process for ourselves quickly.
And this is a big mindset change for you and people who you write about who are more movers as opposed to stayers. The idea that happiness is the next move away, happiness is the next place I go, versus happiness is here if I work to find it. How hard was it to make that mental change?
I think that's something that a lot of us love to think that, you know, I have problems here in this current place. I don't always like my neighbors or my job is tough. But if I move to that new place, I get that clean slate and everything is going to be better. I think of that as the geographic cure, this idea that we're just going to find a new city and all our problems are magically going to be solved and we're going to be the best version of ourselves. So it definitely was a shift to start thinking of, instead of waiting for my place to fix me, thinking of how can I be happy here no matter what's going on in my life. And that's kind of what I really discovered about this concept of place attachment. Place attachment is this idea that we can feel an emotional connection, sort of a relationship with the place where we live. And like any kind of relationship, it takes a while to develop and it takes some work. But once we put down those roots and we establish that connection, it can be really meaningful and really beneficial in our lives.
Here we have this Wisconsin question from our listener, Charles, new to, in this case, Madison, Wisconsin. What is the first step you recommend for someone like Charles to start to get to know a new place?
So I think Charles found the first step on his own, and that's actually realizing that he might have to do something to become a local. I love the question, how does one become a local? Because I think a lot of times we move and we just think that this is going to happen automatically for us. And Charles at least knows that he might have to do some work here, which I think is great. But I would break it down into a three-pronged approach of people, places, and participation, you know, building connections and relationships with other people, finding places that make you happy, and then last, starting to participate, starting to feel a sense of ownership over your place. So for Charles, I would say the number one thing that's going to make him feel more comfortable quicker is to start building human connections with the people around him. When you're moving to a new town, it can be really lonely, and that can be really overwhelming. You miss the place that you moved from. So the faster Charles or anyone else who's new in a town can sort of find their people, find their community, the better off you are. And that can happen in a lot of ways. It could be, you know, joining a rec league soccer team, or finding a church you want to go to, or volunteering, finding some place where people who have your same interests are congregating. I like to think that a really easy way to start this is to get to know your neighbors. Tomorrow, September 28th, actually happens to be National Good Neighbor Day. It's a great chance and a good excuse to just go say hello to your neighbors, take them, you know, some muffins or something, but establish some connections with the people who live around you. It makes you feel more connected fast.
Talking to Melody Warnick, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are, and the forthcoming, If You Could Live Anywhere. She's helping answer a question about how to feel like a local, how to become a local after moving to a new community. You can share your answers to that question at 800-642-1234. How did you settle into a new place after moving? Or do you feel like you haven't become a local? You haven't found those connections yet? Do you need some encouragement? Or if you stay in one place, if you've lived in a place for a long time, how do you help welcome that new person? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Melody, let's stick with those neighbors now. Now, you mentioned finding common interests, like at that church or the soccer league or whatever. Well, the neighbor is luck of the draw. How did you, in your move, build connections with your neighbors who you may or may not have had anything in common with?
So I didn't have anything in common with my neighbors. I write in the book about having a neighbor across the street that had these long dreadlocks and these ear gauges. And I'm, you know, classic middle-aged mom. And I just thought, oh, gosh, like, you know, what are we going to talk about? But I celebrated National Good Neighbor Day. I made some banana muffins and I took them over. And that was what I did. I took banana muffins around to the neighbors that I could see from my house. And the reaction was amazing. And I guess testifies to how seldom this happens. But this neighbor across the street with the dreadlocks was so bowled over to to, you know, get these banana muffins, to have a neighbor approach him and say hi, that he started chatting. He had lived there far longer than we had. He knew the whole history of, you know, everyone who had lived in our house. And even though we didn't become BFFs after that, it became this sort of sweet relationship of, hey, we know each other, and you know, we have each other's backs. We did that for our next door neighbors. And there was a day when I was in an appointment that ran long and needed someone to help pick up one of my daughters, and neighbors were pinch hitting for me. So, you know, your neighbors might not become the people you hang out with all the time, but there are studies that show the more we know and trust our neighbors, not only the healthier we are, it has benefits for our health, makes us less likely to have a heart attack or stroke, but it also makes us feel that sense of happiness and, you know, feeling rooted in the place we are. So it's worth the effort, even if you say, I will never be friends with this person. It's worth it just to, you know, make that effort to say hello.
We're talking to Melody Warnick, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. She's with us today to help answer a question we got from WPR's Why Wisconsin Project about how to get to know a new place after you move. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you, how did you make friends in a new city, a new town? Is it a struggle to put yourself out there at first? Do you wish there was a stronger sense of community where you live right now? Do you like going for walks where you live? Does that help you feel more connected? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Talk. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about getting comfortable, getting connected in a new place after a move, and learning how to love the place you live. Melody Warnick stays with us, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. This is a response to a Why Scottson question, looking to help somebody feel settled in a new community. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with getting used to a new place, finding a sense of community and connection where you live. What do you love about the place you live? Do you feel like a local, even if you're new there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Nancy on Facebook. Nancy writes, I realized I was truly a local when I started referring to places that don't exist anymore. It's by the old Kmart, across the street from the old Westwood School, and so on. I have that with restaurants that aren't there anymore, Melody. But that's, you know, that's something that takes time to get to. Can we jumpstart the process and shorten the time from moving to becoming that local?
Yeah, I love that comment because yeah. I've heard that that is exactly how you know you're a local in New York City, is you can name the last three stores that were in that location. I think, yes, we can shorten the time. So studies show that the average amount of time it takes to become really place attached and to put down those roots is about 3 years. And if you're new in a place and feeling kind of lonely and overwhelmed, 3 years feels like a really long time. So I think you can take action to follow steps that will make you feel more rooted faster. And that was my approach in Blacksburg, Virginia, when I realized I just don't really like it here. I just don't feel at home. I looked at what research said about what makes people feel more attached to their places, and I started doing that in my life. I called them Love Where You Live experiments, and these were just kind of micro action steps that I or anyone could take to sort of strengthen that bond with your place. So some of the things I did were I started trying to become a local at a local restaurant. I shopped more often at independently owned stores. I walked more. I hiked in my area. I volunteered at the local nonprofit movie theater. And all of these things kind of slowly over time had the effect of helping me feel more at home. So there is a time component here. It does sometimes just take a few months or even a few years to really feel like you belong in a place. But I think we can speed it up for ourselves if we're intentional about building place attachment in a new home.
I want to key in on one of those that you just mentioned that I really love, walking in a community. And when I'm traveling, one of my favorite things about a new city is just going for big walks. What is it about walking in particular, as opposed to, say, driving around your community, that gets us more connected?
So studies show that when we drive everywhere, we have windscreen perspective, where all we see is kind of the buildings going by at 40 miles an hour. But when you walk, it's at a human pace that allows you to really observe your surroundings. And when you observe them, you start to feel a sense of ownership. This was one of the first things I did in Blacksburg when I moved here. And so it not only helped me just logistically learn my way around my neighborhood, but I started to see people. Things became familiar. I learned the names of some of the dogs in the neighborhood. And so it's just a way to kind of shrink your place, to feel a sense of ownership over it.
And you went further. You did some guerrilla marketing to try to encourage other people to walk and participate in this national project to put up fun signage. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there is a man named Matt Tomasulo in Raleigh, North Carolina, who realized that walking was one of the great ways that people could connect with their place. But in Raleigh, as in a lot of cities, just no one was doing it. Everyone would hop in their car for every journey. And so he made these signs and he kind of just put them up, no permission, went out at night like a ninja and put these on lampposts, just saying things like, it's a 15-minute walk to the grocery store. It's a 10-minute walk to the park. And he called it Walk Your Place. And he made a way for anyone to make those kinds of signs for their town. And so I did that in Blacksburg, which is another part of what I think helps us feel connected with our place, not just walking, but making things happen in our town, creating something new. Sometimes we call this placemaking, just little actions we can take that make our place better. And so I put up these signs, and they stayed up for about 6 months. I got some comments about them, you know, signs pointing out a local nature center, or it's an 8-minute walk to a historic cemetery. And it was just kind of a way to encourage other people to do some of these Love Where You Live experiments for themselves. I think there's lots of easy ways like that that we can have an impact on our environment and on the people around us that don't take a lot of time and effort, but really bear fruit in terms of our sense of place attachment.
Talking to Melody Warnick, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are, getting strategies and tactics to help us feel like we're part of our community, whether we just moved there or if we've lived there a long time. Still time for your experiences at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melody, I want to flip things around. Were there things that you got from locals in your community that, you know, the long timers maybe, or the people who already lived there that helped you or hindered you from feeling more connected?
Well, when I first moved here, I think the locals were one of the things that made it harder to feel at home. I remember going to the hardware store and feeling like I needed subtitles because the Southern accents were so thick. But one of the things I learned is that people who have lived in a community for a long time are the experts on the community, and they know better than anyone what there is to love about this place. So I learned this tip from someone else who was also new to Blacksburg, but I think it's a great idea for anyone. They would go to restaurants or the farmers market, and they would strike up conversations and ask people, what do you love about it here? And they made a town bucket list of things that they wanted to try that could be anything from, you know, the local duck pond on the university campus to a restaurant that's out of the way that maybe you weren't aware even existed. I think that is such a good suggestion for anyone who's new to a community and trying to feel at home there. Assume that the locals are the experts. They know all the cool stuff that you don't know, and talk to them and, you know, make a bucket list for yourself. What are the things that people come here to your town to do when they go on vacation? So I've been to Madison exactly once, but I have really fond memories of visiting the zoo and the lake and the farmers market and the botanical garden. So I think, you know, going back to Charles' question, mm-hmm. How do I become a local here? Start with those biggies for sure. But once you've crossed those off your list, start asking people, what are the things that people who live in Madison or any town that you live in, what do people love to do here? And then start doing them. I live in a college town. I regret to say, not a huge football fan, but I realize that football is big in my community, and that if I really wanted to become a local here, I was going to have to embrace it. And so it's my theory of do what your town is good at. Your town may not be good at the things you wish it was good at, but it is good at something. So figure out what that is and do it. And for me in Blacksburg, it was going to some Virginia Tech Hokie football games and embracing that experience. And doing stuff like that really helped me feel like I was part of things here.
Time for one quick call. Jonathan is with us in Madison. Jonathan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
So, my wife and I just moved to Madison from Colorado. Before you ask why, it's for school. we've gotten that question from about 20 people as to why we moved from Colorado to Wisconsin, and it's school. But the first thing we did when we got here was find a dog park. Madison has like 20, but we found the closest one to us, and we go like 3 or 4 times a week because we have a dog, and it's a great way to get outside. But then, you know, it's easy to be friendly at a dog park and get to know people. And when you're there that many times a week, you remember faces, and then you talk a lot. And we found, you know, 3 other dog parks that other people like to go to because they're specifically cool. There's one that just opened that's a beer garden and a dog park. And it's like, oh, that's a fantastic place to go hang out.
Jonathan, thanks so much for that call. And we'll give you the last word with some advice to Charles there. And Melody, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. It was great fun.
That was Melody Warnick. She's the author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. She was with us today to answer a question we got from a WPR listener named Charles on our Why Wisconsin project about how to get used to and become a local in a new place. You can submit your question for Why Wisconsin, and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's Wisconsin. And hope to hear from you there, and maybe we'll tackle your question. Coming up, do you still find your next favorite song by listening to the radio? We'll find out how algorithm-driven technology has changed what it's like to find new music, especially on streaming services like the Spotify's and Pandora's and YouTube's of the world. You can start the conversation right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the song Knights of Sidonia in the background by the band Muse. It's one of many bands I've discovered years after they were cool, of course, when they came up on a streaming service. If you use music streaming platforms like Spotify or Pandora or YouTube, there's a good chance that the algorithm technology built into it has helped you find a new favorite artist or song. And while you can still browse a record shop and pick at random, there are cheaper, faster ways. The ways we search for and discover new music has changed quite a bit since the rise of the internet, not necessarily always for the better. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you discover new music to listen to? Do you use things like Spotify Weekly or YouTube recommendations? Do you get introduced to new artists or songs by friends or maybe on the radio? Or do you shop record stores for something cool and new? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Can you talk, first of all, about how radically things have changed in the way people discover music these days?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I mean, you mentioned these services like Spotify and iTunes. I mean, the amount of music now that we have access to is great. But the worry, obviously, with having access to that much music is how do you find what you want to listen to or what you might like to listen to? So these services have gotten really good at trying to answer that question for you. And they've sort of positioned themselves as the ones who can uniquely solve that problem, right? We have all these recommendations for you, thanks to all this great technology we're building that can get you to hear a whole bunch of music you never would have been exposed to otherwise.
You and some of your colleagues around the country recently wrote about this, and you did your best to lift up the hood to look at the so-called artificial intelligence, the algorithms that go into those recommendations that we might see on these services. How much do we know about how that works?
Well, yeah, it's really hard to get a full sense of it because a lot of this stuff is proprietary technology. But, you know, there are enough accounts of how these things get built, and there are journalists who are doing a lot of really good work in terms of unearthing how specific practices work. But yeah, you know, I mean, you're looking at a huge combination in sites like Spotify that involve, you know, lots of technology at work, but also lots of people making decisions about what music, you know, should be featured on certain pages, on certain playlists, and all these different features that the services offer. So, you know, there are certainly a lot of technologies at play, but I also like to remind people that there are also always still a lot of humans involved in this process. So part of that report that we talked about was, you know, reminding people that AI, artificial intelligence, or that algorithms are not just technical things, right? They're also highly cultural. They're designed by people. They're created with certain biases in mind about what music means and how music should be discovered. So always thinking about both the technical elements and the cultural elements of algorithms or AI or any technology is important.
That's a point I want to dig into more, because we hear this with the use of algorithms in so many spheres of our lives these days, not just music suggestions. And this idea that, well, it's scientific, it's an algorithm, it's objective and unbiased. Can you talk about the human element and how it can really be more biased in some ways?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's any number of ways that bias creeps into the process. I mean, you can think of, about, you know, first of all, the amount of tracks that something like Spotify has access to, right? It may be a huge amount, but there's lots of musics that maybe are not represented on Spotify in the first place. So the algorithms aren't going to capture any songs that aren't being licensed to Spotify or that aren't represented by Spotify. But then also, you know, the people who design these algorithms, design these discovery features are designing them with a particular idea of what it means to listen to music in mind and what music is and what popular music is, right? So a lot of times that may not represent the wide variety of musical cultures that are around the world. So always kind of keeping that in mind when we think about how these algorithms work is pretty important.
Talking to Jeremy Morris from UW-Madison, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies, looking at how we discover new music. It's changed a lot with the rise of various streaming services, all trying to help us find new music that fits into our already existing preferences and parameters. Love to hear your own examples, 800-642-1234, of how you have discovered music, past or present. Maybe going back to the old days. What's your memory of discovering a band that you came to love in a record store, on the radio, from a friend, in a movie soundtrack? Or how did you discover a song or an artist yesterday online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy, I know another point of concern, and again, that you and your colleagues wrote about, is this idea that, okay, when I use these services, and I do, a picture is being painted of me, and it can allow people to sell things to me, for example. What kind of things do we know about what they know about me when I'm listening to their music?
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a really interesting element of it, right? Like digitization of music, or the turning of music into these kind of streaming services, has really blown music up into millions of data points, right? So every time we, you know, press play, every time we press skip, every time we skip a track, you know, or we dislike a track or like a track, all those things are signals that get fed back into, you know, their profile of us. And, you know, sometimes that profile works out, but other times that profile can get kind of messed up, right? Sometimes you're listening to Spotify with friends and you may be listening to songs that, you know, aren't your favorite. Sometimes your kids are listening, and that can throw off the algorithms as well, right? So there's all these ways, but, you know, again, Spotify's reacting to this, and not just Spotify, but these music services in general are trying to like find that balance between, you know, what are honest and true signals that we are giving the system versus which ones might be noise. But, you know, that gets really tricky for a system like Spotify to parse. So anytime we're thinking about what shows up on our playlists or what's being recommended to us, right, we always sort of have that question, okay, why? Why is that being featured to me? Why is it telling me that I should be listening to that song or that band now?
Is this necessarily any better or worse, Jeremy, than, you know, well, once upon a time, this record executive determined what got recorded and produced and marketed in my area, or a radio station executive, or a radio station computer in Cincinnati, or whatever the case. is this different, better, worse? I don't know.
Right. I'm glad you pointed that, because there is certainly a long history of how music has been curated for us. Whether you talk about radio DJs, whether you talk about music producers or A&R reps, right? There are all these technologies and roles in which music gets kind of filtered before it comes to us. So in that sense, yeah, no, Spotify's algorithms are not necessarily different. What they do is they add kind of a new element to that, an element which I'd argue, you know, relies heavily, like you were saying, on personal data, on the giving up of kind of intensely personal details about our own kind of habits with listening to music. And so Spotify is really trying to kind of play on that element of it. Now, whether or not you find that invasive or extremely useful is going to depend on the kind of music consumer you are and your relationship with music in that way, right? So I wouldn't necessarily say it's any better. I'd say music has always come to us as a result of decisions that were partly made by people, but also, you know, decisions or factors that are filtered through the technology that music comes to us through, whether that's the CD, the cassette tape, the radio, right? Any of those things all have their own kind of mechanisms, again, for shaping how we understand music.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Cato. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? So my comments are, you know, I definitely use the streaming services, but they seem to only, you know, suggest music that's at a, you know, a higher production value. And what I really miss is, you know, back when I was younger, going to check out live shows at places like Concert Cafe in Green Bay, where you'd maybe know one person playing or one band playing, and there'd be like three other bands, you know, and you'd leave with a new DVD or a new CD or a vinyl and, you know, some new music. It's really hard to try and find something new now if you're just using the, you know, Pandoras and things like that.
Jeremy, that's an interesting point. And guest Jeremy Morris, is there a threshold, you know, we're not going to discover that completely unheard of band in our streaming service?
I guess it depends. You know, I'll definitely agree here that one of the things that is problematic about algorithmic recommendation is that you can fall into this loop of like, if I keep listening to the things that sound similar to what I like, then I'm going to keep hearing the same things recommended back to me, right? So we may, you know, our kind of recommendations may be kind of closed in terms of how they come to us, right? I do think, you know, these services do offer a huge amount of music. So, you know, with a bit of poking around and trying to listen to different things, you can start to hear those different recommendations come to you. And yeah, things like Spotify's Discover Weekly playlist start to do that. But yeah, do you miss the ability to find these you know, this kind of smaller or lesser known artists, right, that don't necessarily have the resources, don't necessarily get as many plays as some of the other bands, right? So I think there's still very much a question about like how Spotify as a global service provider interacts with like local music cultures and what you'd hear, like what Jeremy's describing about, you know, the local bands that may not necessarily be on Spotify or may not be, you know, huge and making a lot of noise on that, enough noise to get recommended onto playlists.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about how technology has changed the way we discover new music. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you find new music? Do you use a Spotify Weekly or other playlists generated by Spotify? Do you bounce around on Pandora or YouTube or iTunes or wherever you're getting your music from? Or do you have other ways to discover new stuff? Do you think technology has made it easier to find music you might otherwise have not heard? Or does it just give you more of the same? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about streaming technology and how it's changed the way that we discover music. And we want to hear how you discover music at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the first time you heard a band that you love? Was it live at a show? Was it on the radio? Did a friend play it for you on an album or cassette tape or 8-track or CD, or was it streaming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Ethan is with us in Avon. Ethan, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Just wanted to say that I think Spotify is pretty great. It is limited in certain aspects. I think your previous caller mentioned you get kind of pigeonholed into a really similar artists. For example, I listen to a lot of obscure types of music, progressive and technical mass rock kind of music, and I listen to the more heavy side of things. My girlfriend likes the same bands, and she listens to a little bit of the lighter side, so between the both of us, we get recommended a really broad spectrum, but we both find things that each other would like that we might not have otherwise, you know, found. And also, we find a lot of bands that you just would never have heard about. You know, they have, like, 100 monthly listeners or something like that, and then that can, you can take that away and go follow them on their own pages and purchase their music from them directly. I think that's a great way to kind of bridge the gap between old industry and the new form of listening to music.
Ethan, thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Jeremy, but what do you think about Ethan's strategy?
Yeah, no, I think that's great, and I love that point at the end too of, you know, taking it beyond just, oh, I heard this band on Spotify and I like that song, and then, you know, forgetting about it, you know, the next week when we get a new list of recommendations, but, you know, following up, listening, you know, on their other kind of outlets they're participating in, going to the concert, right? Because that's when you also get that other kind of exposure of like, oh, you know, the opening bands that opened for them, right? And I wouldn't be exposed to them either, right? So I think that's one of the great benefits and promises, certainly, of a service like Spotify is that they do have such a wide catalog that you would be recommended songs that you wouldn't necessarily run into every day, right? Whether or not that promise is always true for all listeners is a different question, but certainly, yeah, like the ability to do that and to find those gems that way can be very exciting.
Ethan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. You can share your musical discovery voyages with us at 800-642-1234. Do you stream? How do you stream? How do you find new stuff? Or do you like other ways of discovering new music? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Torsten is with us in Chippewa Falls. Torsten, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It's all nice to discover all this new music through those streaming services, but you only will be able to hear those musicians if they can make money, and most streaming services pay almost nothing to those musicians. I mean, the worst ones would be Pandora and YouTube, then maybe Spotify in the middle of the road, and the services that pay a bit better, it would be Tidal or and Napster. And the best thing is to buy still CDs from the musicians, because if you want to listen to good music, you have to make sure that musicians can make a living.
Torsten, thanks a lot for bringing that up, Jeremy. Torsten brings up an important point that you and I have talked about in past conversations. What does this all mean for the musicians, especially for the non-huge names, as Torsten was saying, who are hoping to make enough money to keep playing music?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you reminded me that we did talk, because I was like, I think we talked about this in an episode before. But yeah, you know, certainly the royalty structure for streaming services is extremely complicated. You know, artists get paid a percentage of the total streams, you know, so the actual amount that ends up going to an artist given, you know, in a given month or something like that can be quite minimal. I will also say that, you know, even though the CD might be a little bit more in terms of that, the royalty structure there, depending on their record contract, mm-hmm. is still quite out of whack. So, you know, it depends on the artist in terms of what the best way to support them is. You see, luckily now, a lot of new platforms that are trying to make the connection between your donation or your play or your money and the artist receiving that a little bit closer, right? So whether that's tip jars, whether that's straight up donations through some of the channels that they're now able to participate on social media are great ways. Live concerts are another good ways in most cases to support artists. So yeah, I completely agree with everything that's being said there, that's a highly problematic part of the streaming music economy. But again, you know, balancing that with the exposure that these services might offer to artists is something that I know at least some independent musicians find quite helpful.
Thanks for that call, Torsten. Also on the economic side of things, Jeremy, I always wonder, am I hearing this band because somebody paid for me to hear this band, whether a record label or the artists themselves? If a radio station did that, they used to call that payola, and people could go to jail for that. Is that something that's happening behind the scenes for streaming?
Right. And that's really hard to tell a lot of those things. Spotify used to run a feature called Spotlight. And it was a kind of promotion type deal with independent artists. I'm not sure if they're running it still or if they've rebranded it. In fact, I think they did because a few weeks ago I saw something in the news on it. But, you know, it was this service where, like, if you were seen to be an up and coming artist on Spotify, they would get in touch with you and they, you know, through some kind of deal, they'd put you in a special part of their website and feature your songs in some playlists. But again, you know, a lot of that stuff that goes on in terms of how and who gets placed on what playlists is not totally transparent to us. So as a listener, definitely asking that question of like, how did that music get there? And is it just there because it sounds like other things that I listen to? Or is it there because, you know, somebody had a vested interest in making it get there? You also have, like you have with Google, you know, search engine optimization, you have companies and artists who get really good at trying to, you know, like play with the metadata of their songs, mess with the keywords in their song titles so that their songs show up in your searches in Spotify before other ones. So that's not necessarily like the person paid to be there, but they are trying to kind of game the system in a particular way.
Time for one more caller. Linda is with us in Rhinelander. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm coming to you with a little bit of a different angle, I think, here, and possibly a different generation with a lot less technology in my life. But I religiously listen to CBS Sunday Morning, and they feature a new artist, a new group, or not necessarily new, but new to me. And they give that artist enough time that you can really find out if you like them or not. They interview them and they give them three or four songs to do in a segment. And if I like them and go, wow, I'd like to listen to that, I put them in Pandora and then I follow along with them on that. I really love it.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Jeremy, still people reaching out to different media to get their first taste of some artists.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fantastic. And I love the way Linda was talking about context there, right? Like mm-hmm. being able to get a bit of the context around the band for some listeners is really important to be like, do I want to invest in this band? Do I want to listen to them more? It's not just, did I like the music? It's like, you know, can I get a sense of the story behind the band as well? But yeah, you know, I think as sort of a closing thought on that, right? Like, if I want to use a bit of the language of algorithms and AI, right? Diversifying the inputs in terms of like how you get new music is always a useful procedure, I think, right? So don't just rely on one particular way of getting it, right? Don't just rely on Spotify's recommendations, right? Talk to your friends about music, you know, go into a record store every once in a while, right? There's all these different means through which, you know, turn on the radio, right? There's all these different means through which we can have songs kind of introduced to us. And I think kind of spreading that out as much as possible will kind of hopefully, you know, give you a bit of a wider exposure there.
Thanks for the call, Linda. It's just our last 30 seconds or so, Jeremy. Would you like to see more transparency for how these algorithms work so we know why we're getting what we're getting?
Yeah, I think more transparency, both in terms of how the algorithms work, but also in terms of, you know, like who's behind the algorithms, right? What are the ideas they have about music and about why they're building the things they're building, right? A lot of that stuff is very opaque to customers, very difficult to see. And so therefore, when we see that music, we're not entirely sure, you know, how it got there and why.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about how technology has changed the way we discover music. You can find a link to some research he's done at wpr.org/centraltime. And you could share your stories of how you discover music over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Here's a question that's interesting to me as someone who plays a wind instrument. How much virus can you spread while you're playing? And is there a way for musicians to limit the risk? A new study tried to put that to the test and found out the best bet is to turn things inside out. Researchers worked at the Utah Symphony to figure out the best ways to limit the risk of disease spread. The symphony was interested because of COVID, but the research could help with other viral illnesses. I'm a little less interested because I play saxophone, which you don't usually see in your symphony orchestra. Anyhow, researchers found that by changing the traditional seating arrangement, you could limit exposure to those droplets that wind players shoot through their instruments. The key, getting the instruments that put out the most droplets toward the edges near open doors on the side and then pointing them away from everybody else. So who's the big droplet producer? According to the study anyway, number three is the trombone at 300 particles per liter of air exhaled through the instrument. Number two is the oboe, 400 particles per liter. Number one, trumpet, a whopping 2,500 particles per liter. So I've got a better solution than moving the trumpets to the edge. Keep moving them out the door. Replace them with some saxophones. This is Central Time.